That I can check for questions, or yeah, old-fashioned way, put your hand up and maybe wait for the microphone and ask us a question that way. So maybe Keir, if you want to just maybe quickly introduce yourself so people know, I'm sure most people do know who you are, but maybe your role with the ATO.
Thanks, Sarah. Can I just check that you can hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Cool, thank you. Yeah, look, apologies again for not being able to be there today. I tested positive for COVID relatively recently, and so for everybody's benefit, thought it was better to do this remotely. Yeah, so I'm the Assistant Commissioner responsible for the Economist Practice. The Economist Practice within the ATO is a centralised economic function, and we have a very important role in terms of being the only part of the ATO that can provide what we call accredited economic advice. And so obviously that's really important for transfer pricing. So my team of 100-odd economists will be supporting very much the case teams as they interact with you and your clients on these cases.
Has he stopped talking, or we can...
You able to hear me still?
Yes. Thank
you. Okay.
Lovely. Thanks for that introduction, Keir. Sorry, I can't quite see you, so... Oh, now I can. You're in front of me now. That's good. So, look, the first session, it was a great scene setting for this discussion, and I think that we heard some very insightful sharing around tariffs, the economic environment, particularly in the context of the US. And I think it really illustrates the importance of us as advisors and corporates thinking about transfer pricing and customs together. And I think probably a lot of people in the room would agree that that's not always the case. And customs and tariffs is usually looked after by a team outside of the tax team. And so, you know, that one step removed sometimes means that it's not often thought about together. So I think one of the aims for today's session is that we really want you all to leave, you know, with that very strong appreciation of the importance to be linking the two together and thinking about both of them at the same time. So maybe just some initial scene setting. I'm going to ask David, what are some of the factors that are impacting global trade? And I guess particularly focusing on what us as tax advisors in the room or transfer pricing advisors in the room need to be thinking about, which could be signals for something that we do need to be thinking about.
That's a very big question. What impacts trade in a way that concerns you? At the end of the first panel, we were talking about the fact that this change is happening quickly. Now, I was in the U.S. government for three administrations, and the Obama administration is a great example of impact right now. He campaigned, you remember his campaign? Do you remember, because a lot of people here tell me they remember that very specifically, campaigned on one word, change. And unlike a lot of politicians, when he got to the White House, he tried to do it. He actually went out and he appointed smart people to run agencies. Not agency people to run agencies, but professors and outsiders who had opinions that were very well respected. And in his first term, if you weren't there for it, it ground to a halt because change happened too quickly. They had to backtrack. Here, most of you in the room are from Sydney. Down at the harbor, they have the ships come in, the big cruise ships. If you turn the wheel on one of those ships 1 degree, at the end of the day, that ship is in a very different place than it would have been. If you spin the wheel, the buffet is just going to get upset, and all the people on the Lido deck are going to end up in the pool. That's what's going on. And you are advising people through that kind of turmoil. So, and one of the things you mentioned, Paul, was sort of the secondary effects, ancillary effects. I'll think about why some of these things are being implemented, and that's a problem because it's not an economically based, sound economically based policy. It's more of an emotional policy of we've been wronged, this will right it. Secondary impacts can go in a lot of directions, and they're not contemplated as part of the end goal. As tax professionals, certainty seems to me something you would rather like, something that would be important to your function. If you find it difficult to navigate this, what are your clients thinking? Where are they? The fact that you have the knowledge you have is exceedingly important right now and very helpful to traders around the world. Do you have any?
I'll probably just add in relation to kind of how it impacts trade more broadly is that the US measures a kind of extension what happened around Trump's first administration, and some people may recall that initially we had the US as part of the CPTPP agreement, which was kind of the multilateral free trade agreement that Obama was pushing for the US to kind of tie itself to Asia, and the US obviously withdrew from that following the Trump's first administration. And what that resulted in is obviously the withdrawal of US rules of commerce in the Indo-Pacific being supplanted by RCEP, which is the Chinese-led multinational agreement that we're also part of. And so, as I kind of alluded to at the start of the presentation around, we're going to see a regionalization of trade given what's going to happen around activities moving away from the US to find volume elsewhere in Asia, supported by a rules-based system that's led by China, has pretty broad ramifications around businesses that operate in the region and export to the region outside of the US. That's probably the second thing I'd add.
And I just, on a personal note, the first FTA that I worked on for the United States was NAFTA, and the last was TPP. So Donald Trump and I probably don't see eye to eye on trade. You mentioned RCEP, and in the first panel, we talked a lot about rules of origin, and RCEP is one of the few plurilateral agreements that largely harmonizes rules of origin across the group as opposed to bilaterally between the countries of the group. And that's a big step. It made no news because it's boring. But if you streamline trade like that, the administrative aspects of it, and everybody knows how things are going to be treated within that block, the potential gains, the potential efficiencies gained at that point are tremendous. So not only did the U.S. leave what's now the CPTPP, but RCEP has come in, and at least in some aspects, it's a very interesting agreement and one that can be utilized.
Thank you. I guess what I'd also add, observation, you know, working with clients, large multinationals, is there's been a lot of change in recent years, and I think really what we have now is an acceleration and a higher level of uncertainty, not just because of the Trump administration, because of, you know, other things that are happening in the world, you know, geopolitical issues as well. And I certainly know when I'm talking to my clients, they are considering restructuring how they operate. They're considering diversification in terms of where they're supplying, where they're sourcing their supplies, diversification in terms of, you know, gone are the days where you might have one, you know, manufacturing source, and I think COVID put the end to that for a lot of organisations as well. So multiple locations. Diversification in terms of, well, if, you know, country X has got a better rate and the US is an important market, then let's, you know, try to slowly move some manufacturing to country X rather than country Y. Now, of course, none of this can happen overnight. And so there's a really important consideration in, you know, how do you respond to the level of uncertainty? Because you could make a decision to move, let's say, manufacturing from country X to country Y, and then, you know, Trump attacks country Y and all things change again. So there's a lot of caution, I think, in terms of what multinationals are actually doing in practice and sort of looking at the wait and see. And maybe one question to sort of close out, not close out, but to maybe help the audience, and you probably don't know the answer to this, either of you, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's your, if you had a crystal ball, what is your assessment of when we might see this settling down so that organisations can start to make decisions in terms of, you know, what should their supply chains look like? You know, what should their sourcing look like? Are we talking 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, or is there just not going to be certainty under the Trump administration?
Do you want to start that one?
I'll give it a go. So I think there has been some levelling out. I think August is a big milestone. I think we do have some form of level set, although that level set provides for substantial complexity, as David spoke to, in relation to now we have all these different rates based on commodity and origin that are subject to separate agreements and deals. How do we manage this and implement this? One thing I'd add around kind of the ability to diversify and restructure is that businesses, including multinationals, aren't necessarily established to do that with agility. So in order to move manufacturing or look at alternate markets, you need to understand a lot of the kind of information that we talked about. So you need to know the HS codes of all your products. You need to know the importer of record obligations and whether you can be importer of record and what that creates at the border for that product. You need to know about the free trade agreements and tariffs and how you comply. And businesses don't tend to have that information readily available because there's no governance over it, because it tends to sit with logistics. And it has more than a tax impact. So the HS code may drive tariffs, but also drives whether the product is subject to food standards in that country or whether there's a protocol in place. So CHAFTA provides for pork to be duty-free into China, but until there's a protocol allowing me to sell pork in China from Australia, that means nothing. Similar around TGA and health certification. So the information and having that information available to support modelling and understanding impacts to your value chain quickly is a big value add that tax can provide, but is being limited in its ability to provide it because they don't necessarily have ownership of that information currently.
It's a very important question. It's so far the most important question, I think, that anybody's asked. When? And my answer may sound a bit unfortunate. In my perspective, there's two elements to this. There's chaos and there's tariffs. What's the objective of the policy and how is it working? It's unstable. It is unpredictable, creating leverage for negotiating, and it's working by the perspective of the people implementing it. So, and it works for things that are not economically based. You can go after Brazil because of a court case, or you can go after India for buying Russian oil instead of somebody else's oil, which is economic in a way, but it's more national security and otherwise. Chaos is part of the plan. Therefore, as long as the decision makers are there and it's working, who knows when the variations will end? That's one thing. And if it's working, don't fix it. You know, if you look at it objectively, if they're happy with their results so far, they keep going. But the other is tariffs themselves. And those are very hard to get rid of. The tariffs themselves could outlast, and very well could outlast, the decision makers in this case, because one, they create dependencies very quickly. And so in Washington, You don't back out of your driveway in the morning without a trade lawyer and a lobbyist. And if you have tariffs that are protecting your industry, you're going to want to keep them. That is going to be a very loud voice in Washington at some point in the coming future. Consumers don't necessarily know what choices they don't have in front of them based on how these things are going to advance. So consumer groups will not necessarily be very helpful in moving this along. Politicians like revenue streams. When's the last time you saw somebody give up billions of dollars of revenue to potentially build up and rebuild prosperity 20 years down the road, which is what trade generally does? It's a rising graph. It's not an instant. It's this. Tariffs will be around for a while. So when, hopefully, more stable, the chaos element goes, the tariffs stay, we have a new paradigm.
Yeah, I think there's also a once bitten, twice shy to all this. So a lot of people in 2018 implemented, when China was first targeted, a China plus one strategy, right? And they're like, we'll have manufacturing in Vietnam and Cambodia, tend to be the plus one. And then what happened? Cambodia and Vietnam had huge trade deficits because they started exporting a lot to the US. And so when Trump had his eloquent equation, which obviously led to farcical things around penguins being tariffed in some island, it was deliberate in that Cambodia and Vietnam initially had a 49% and 46% tariff because their deficit grew so much. So I think a lot of businesses who did seek to move manufacturing quickly to Vietnam and Cambodia were initially substantially impacted from that. And so the reason Trump went so broad-based and early was to prevent things like that from happening. It's like whack-a-mole.
Just very quick, as to the increase in that deficit, Switzerland, surprised by their 39% tariff, in between April 2nd and August 1st, a lot of people bought gold because they didn't know where the economy was going. Where does a lot of that come from? Switzerland. Trade deficit went like that. And suddenly they're hit with 39% tariff. You talked about transformation. What are companies doing differently? The best responses I've seen so far have started with what they're doing now. How can we make this, does this fit? And are we doing this as efficiently and as well as we can in the circumstances so that we don't have to change? That's the first port of call. Don't jump in, because the easy solution is probably anticipated.
Thank you. I think that's really good scene setting for maybe now jumping in, as we say, into a little bit more of the TP discussion. And perhaps what better way to start than to hear what the ATO's observations are? What are some of the ATO's concerns? Are there any red flags that, you know, taxpayers should be thinking of? So maybe I might sort of pose this first question to you, Kia. What are the ATO's concerns or observations, more importantly, in relation to this sort of changing trade environment?
Yeah, look, excuse me. I think that's a really wonderful segue, actually, that line about don't just jump in. I think from an ATO perspective, that's very much what's in our mind at the moment. For obvious reasons, I'm very mindful of COVID today. And if I think about the impact that COVID had in terms of the Australian economy and how we responded to that from a transfer pricing perspective, the outcome was probably not as bad as first feared in terms of what it meant for our economies and our profit margins. And so therefore, the headline message for me, I think, is probably don't assume the worst. Again, looking back at the COVID experience, the ATO took a very steady-as-she-goes kind of approach. We didn't preemptively change profit expectations that we'd published in relation to our inbound distributors, etc. And in hindsight, we were shown to be correct in that. We did have an opportunity in that context of probably having a more multilateral approach to the change than perhaps is possible in the current geopolitical environment. So we did have some OECD guidance as well as ATO guidance in relation to COVID. And the themes there were really very much a strong emphasis on having a careful analysis rather than just a knee-jerk kind of narrative to the impact of the disruption, emphasising the importance of contemporaneously recording what had happened and why, and then also the importance of evidence, and again, digging beneath that kind of narrative. From an ATO perspective, we're very mindful that the government's priority remains tax avoidance task force focus, which is very important. In our mind, that means we need to ensure that Australian taxes aren't avoided so as to cross-subsidised additional taxes being paid elsewhere in the world. I mean, we've seen $100 billion worth of tariffs collected in the US this year. Presumably, largely, that's coming out of an M&E's pocket. Question if they can pass it on to a consumer, but if not, it's somewhere in their supply chain. Nobody likes to take that kind of hit to their bottom line, so we need to be careful about what that will do in terms of behaviours. But at the same time, we do understand that this is a great time of uncertainty and disruption and really want to work with people to understand what the impacts are. So back to you, Zara.
Thanks, Keir. Maybe it's a good segue into probably what is the biggest question in the room, I'm sure is the biggest question in the room, is that who should bear the risk and the cost of these increase in tariffs? Now, I know you're going to go back and talk about facts and circumstances, and that's obviously a really important starting point for any transfer pricing analysis, but I think it is the big, big question. If you can't pass those increased costs on to consumers, then there is the question as to, you know, who should bear those costs? How should those costs be borne if there is an impact on profit margins? What's the ATO perspective on that?
I'll give you a personal perspective on that as opposed to an ATO view, because, as I say, I think we're not rushing to put out guidance on it. I think it comes back to first principles in a lot of ways, which is around what's the evidence that we're seeing in terms of margins made by comparables. And so if I think about it from an inbound supply chain perspective, it may well be that distribution margins are hit and that we do see contractions in terms of profitability. And that might then mean that we take a different view as to what's an appropriate outcome from an Australian perspective. But there's probably at least as good a chance, if not better, that we're not going to see that kind of impact coming through in our independent distributors. And so it would be unfair for independent distributors to be paying higher taxes than controlled distributors simply because M&E was trying to recoup its costs somewhere else in its operation. And so that evidence around what are we seeing in terms of the comparables is really important. And secondly, I think it's important to remember the kind of assumptions that are built into the transfer pricing guidelines about entities operating in their own commercial kind of interests and have regard to, as things change, what's the impact, what's the drivers from an Australian perspective. And it may make sense from a holistic M&E perspective, and we accept that that is obviously going to be foremost in a board's mind. But the challenge we have as regulators is to think about it also from the perspective of what's in the commercial interest of the Australian business and to try and ensure that there is the right regard paid for those commercial drivers locally as well as just the commercial drivers globally.
Thanks, Keir. And then maybe following on from that then, has there been any discussion or dialogue between tax authorities in relation to this point? Do you get the sense that there is alignment in terms of the view that the ATO has?
I think I have the privilege of being an Australian representative on Working Party 6 at the OECD, and that's jargon. But what it really means is I get to sit in the OECD with a bunch of people and talk about transfer pricing and transfer pricing guidelines, etc. And over the course of the last 12 months, it would be fair to say that it's been a fairly diverse and uncertain environment within the OECD, because as we've heard on the panel already, there is a huge amount of uncertainty, and the kind of whiplash from US policy in terms of what are the tariffs today versus this afternoon is really significant. And a lot of the old kind of assumed perhaps commonalities in terms of the importance of free trade and how it will manifest and how it will be supported are far less clear today than they were 12 months ago. And so I don't personally see a great deal of multilateral approach to this response at the moment, and I personally wouldn't expect to see it for some time yet until things settle down in terms of what's the US approach to things.
Thank you. And I think your comment before about waiting to see or expecting to see no impact, or what is the impact for independent distributors? I mean, the challenge I think that taxpayers have and advisors will have as well is that it's going to take some time for that data to flow through, as it did for COVID. So indeed, your comments you made before in terms of probably what a lot of people were expecting to be the financial impact of COVID didn't necessarily always show through in the data that came through. So I think we've got that same level of uncertainty now for the next at least probably 2 to 3 years, while we actually wait and see what is the data flow, the financial impact in those independents. I guess I just wanted to pick up on an observation that was made, which just shows perhaps different extreme views, which is where I think conflict is going to arise in relation to this whole, you know, tariff uncertainty. When I was in Miami in February this year attending the TP Mines event there, this was a big topic then. That was late February, and you know, things were just starting to sort of explode, if you like. And they might have settled down a little bit more now, or at least there's probably a little bit more sort of understanding as to what the end game might look like or what the end game options might be. But the strong view in the room, and it was discussed on a number of panels, the strong view in the room was on the US import side, that it wouldn't be the distributors in the US that were bearing any of that risk. It would be the manufacturers, the suppliers. And so I think that this is going to raise some interesting questions and interesting debates in terms of, is it a market factor? Is it an issue in terms of the manufacturer or supplier wanting to enter into that market? So therefore, you know, they bear some of that cost. But they had very, very strong views in that room about how this should be dealt with. So I don't know whether maybe anybody in the room here also perhaps has some observations or some comments in relation to whether they agree or they disagree with that, or you know, what they see as perhaps the unfortunate consequences of these differing views that are going to be coming through.
I think, there's no such thing as a limited risk distributor, but we still refer to them as limited risk. And I would have thought that they're going to continue to be limited risk. And if they've got fixed operating margins, they're going to flow through, and the rest of that is going to sit, you know, the impact of the tariffs will sit up the chain. I think to the extent it does hit distribution margins for independent comps, then that may lower the returns for the US distributors. But again, that's probably going to take a number of years to flow through until we actually get that data.
Yep, thanks, Sean. Agreed. Any different views?
Hi, Zara. Not a different view, more coming back to one of the points you mentioned, but in this context, but didn't then elaborate on, which is economic circumstances, one of the four factors of comparability in the OECD guidelines. And to my mind, when searching for comparables, and looking at how benchmarking studies have been done traditionally to date using transactional net margin method, the economic circumstances factors tend to be brushed over. Whereas if you've got, particularly in the US more so than Australia, if you've got independent distributors that are not being impacted in the same way as other independent distributors in your comp set, then, or if that matter is not being looked at in order to form a view that your comps that you've used in the past, pre the tariff disruption, are still the comps that you should be using going forward, post tariff disruption, then there could be a deficiency in the documentation. I note Keir's comment in the context of COVID that at least in relation to Australian distributors, the data that the tax office had regard to in relation to what they put out in their distributor PCG, inbound distributor PCG, they didn't see much movement in the distribution margins that were being made pre and post COVID. So it's an observation about something that perhaps should be looked at, but I can't tell you today what the outcome might be because we haven't seen the impacts flow through to the financials in the accounts that are then in the databases.
Yeah, thanks, Damien. I think that's actually the big challenge here, isn't it? But multinationals need to make those pricing decisions and profit allocation decisions or loss allocation decisions now. They can't wait 2 or 3 years to see what the market or the data is going to show. I think you wanted to make a comment.
Yes, actually, it's several interesting points. In talking about who pays, of course, ex-US, you want the consumer to pay, not just because that's where the payment would be made, but the impact of a policy that isn't favorable then impacts the policymaker. You'd rather have that. But the other point you made is, when do you know what the impacts are? That's a problem when you're talking about the US. Economists have been doing all kinds of gymnastics since this all started. One terrific study I saw had a rather raunchy name. It was a FAFO chart. And I won't use F, I'll clean it up and say MAFO. If you mess around, you'll find out. And it was how resilient you would be to changes in your domestic policy towards international trade. Not surprisingly, Singapore was number two as the most vulnerable. If they mess around with their trade policy, it's gonna immediately impact them, and it's gonna do that in a big way. It's an island. Everything has to come in and out. The United States was actually third lowest on the list. That does two things. That means the impacts aren't going to necessarily be felt immediately because the way their economy is set up has some resilience to it. But also, Singapore has the advantage of, if they do that, they find out now, they reverse course. These guys could be years down the track before they say, hey, this isn't going the way we hoped it would. And the consequences are baked in at that point. So it's an interesting question, and how do you plan for it?
I think the planning is, sorry if I can follow on, I think the planning is very, very difficult. And I think your response to my observation was very, at a very big picture level and very useful in that context. At a transfer pricing level, and there's a potential disconnect here with the transaction value under the tariff regime that you were talking about in session one. In transfer pricing, probably the two most common methods used, so it's transactional net margin method, but you're either testing net profit margin based on essentially resales, or you're testing cost-based margin based on the cost to, in this case, let's say a distributor, that the distributor incurs in acquiring the goods, and then what should it be selling those onto a related party. So the transfer pricing method is particularly important here, obviously, for transfer pricing purposes. But there might be a disconnect, and you did allude to this in the first session, between the transactional value method, which is the first one that you've got to consider for customs or tariff duty purposes, and what might be happening on the ground with transfer pricing. And that's before you get into any transfer pricing adjustment mechanisms that you also referred to. So I suppose it would be interesting to understand your views on how the transactional value or the potential for any disconnect between the transfer pricing and the tariff determination of taxable value might impact the importer or the distributor in the say the US, because I think that's where there potentially is more likely to be an increasing disconnect that will be potentially difficult to manage by the group.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing to consider is how you're managing that margin, right? So if you have a limited risk distributor operating under TNMM in the US at, say, 3 to 6%, the assumption is you're going to manage that through managing COGS. But what many people might look to do is now, before we look to manage COGS, can we recover management fees, administrative fees, and license fees from the limited risk distributor to minimise the extent to which we manage COGS, which has a duty impact? So it's not one for one. It's how do we manage the margin, and how do we, to Keir's point, ensure that that is contemporaneously supportable in terms of how we're interacting, what we're recovering, and how we price that recovery to mitigate the impact of the tariff cost. What we have seen, we've seen this, and I'll speak to the Australian customs perspective, following COVID, is it's not uncommon, and Australian Border Force has accepted substantial reductions in COGS in more recent years to account for the flow-on effect and recovery of COVID impact in prior years. So 60% reduction in COGS at the border to mitigate the fact of inventory write-down and prior year profitability loss is something that customs can assess. Where there's an interesting dynamic is you'll tend to see the disconnect more pronounced where the revenue collection agencies are different. So in Australia, you've got ABF and you've got the ATO. In the UK, they're one and the same, so they're far more in sync with one another. The US is the same, right? You've got US Border Protection, and then you've got the Inland Revenue Service. And so they operate independently around how they assess these things. So all you need to demonstrate to customs is that you have an arm's length value, and that arm's length value may be lower because there's a bunch of intangibles that you've stripped out of that value that aren't dutiable at customs law. And so that's probably the main thing we're seeing. But customs, and again, speaking from the Australian perspective, are also more likely to accept extraordinary adjustments to goods value to account for prior economic things that have caught up. So we're seeing the impact of COVID now, inventory write-downs, store closures, stock write-offs, et cetera.
Can I just pick up on, before we come back to the TP, and I'd just 30-second warning, Keir, I'd like to come back and talk about documentation and underlying analysis and expectations that the ATO has in terms of how we deal with some of these challenges that we're talking about. But, Paul, you mentioned bifurcating management fees, you know, services, maybe license fees. And it reminds me of maybe a customs planning opportunity that perhaps the room's not that familiar with, so unbundling concepts. So some organisations, I think, do just fully load everything into their COGS, and then that import price is what's subject to duty. But there is opportunity to reduce that actual tariff cost. Do you maybe want to expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So what's commonly referred to as unbundling, and the customs laws, especially in Australia, don't have an element of anti-avoidance. Something is either in the customs value at law or it is not. And businesses can elect to determine whether they want to separately price out aspects. So an embedded royalty under certain circumstances, if bifurcated, may not be dutiable. that is a more contentious position and requires more criteria to go through, but there's certain things that are far less contentious. So anything associated with post-importation, that could be know-how, store format, post-importation services, engineering services, stuff that just doesn't form part of the goods at the time of importation, software that may not be activated or embedded at the time of importation. So think Echo Dots and other devices that have a high value, but that a value is accruing to the intangible or IP embedded in it, not the plastic device itself. The use of a buying agent. So if I have even an intercompany acting as an agent to source goods and they have a margin or a buying commission, if they're acting for the benefit of the buyer or importer and not the seller, then that can prima facie be taken out of the customs value. Historically, as duty rates have come down, and obviously you need to consider withholding tax as you seek to pull things out, the effort and reward to unbundle has been less and less and less. That's coming back because of what we're seeing in the US. So it is what business is looking to consider. In the TP context, when you're utilising a method that seeks to kind of a land at kind of a return on sales or business profitability, how you are managing that margin maybe historically hasn't had as much concern in the context of distribution, but if you are providing management service fees or administrative fees to an offshore, that can be priced separately, and therefore you're not looking at COGS. And so what has always been the case of high duty jurisdictions, which the US is now one of them, is businesses looking at how intangibles are managed in the context of their customs values, but being very careful because obviously it could have broader direct tax and transfer pricing consequences. And although they don't necessarily need to align completely, there's always going to be a Venn diagram, and you need to ensure that those differences are defendable based on the different regimes and different laws.
Thanks, Paul. I think really, really important concepts there, because we don't see it enough where there is that attempt to reduce. I mean, it's a cost, tariff is a cost, but if there are opportunities within the law to reduce those costs, then, you know, corporates in the room, you know, it's worth going back and checking whether your organisation is actually taking advantage of that, and advisors in the room speaking to your clients about that.
And that's quite important. It goes back to... It touches on a point I made earlier about not jumping, but actually looking at your processes and doing them as well as you can, given the change in circumstances. That's what this is, really. It's things have changed. If you take an example of two benevolent small enterprises in two countries, one makes the widget, the other buys it because it's integral to what they are manufacturing. And this small entity is the largest supplier for this small entity, and this small entity is the biggest customer for that one. The receiving company suddenly has its contract that it already has fulfilled with an extra 900,000 US duty owing on what was delivered. Okay, that's going to put little guy here out of business, which subsequently is going to put little guy over there out of business. So what are you going to do? These are benevolent, these are symbiotic, they're working together. This is a happy Disneyland sort of scenario. This is not cutthroat, this is not business. This is a hypothetical. One thing I'm getting at is that not only do you have to plan for the way you're going to do things going forward and figure out how to navigate it, but you have to go back and forensically reassess all the agreements that you're in now to understand how it might impact you going forward and what you need to renegotiate or reevaluate in that to avoid those kind of costs. And the problem that you can get when you say, who pays for this, is who in the chain has the best lawyer? Who has the best tax people? Who works together and who doesn't? You know, if you're not careful, and it could impact the whole chain. Because if that middleman is the one that bears the brunt, they could go away. They could become less viable, more unstable. Everybody else's risk goes up with that too. So how are you doing things, and how are you ensuring the certainty of your supply chain is important, and all of these aspects go into it. Goes back, and I'll put my law firm hat on and say, what is the deal you've made? And how have you built the regulatory requirements into it, into the business terms that you've agreed? And those regulatory requirements have changed and are changing and are evolving. Who's going to help you with that, and how are you going to evaluate it? That's the question right now.
I think really, really good tips. You probably just used up your tips that I was going to ask you at the end. What tips did you want to leave with the room? I'm sure you can think of more. Kia, let's jump back, because I'm conscious of time. Let's jump back and talk about documentation and what the ATO's expectations are. And I think that Damien picked up on a good point before. A lot of times taxpayers have got budgets, they've got limited resources, and they've got lots of other things that they're working on. And so when changes like this happen, and they're constantly happening, we saw this through COVID. It's very difficult for taxpayers to find the time to do too much more than they're already doing. So what's the ATO's expectations in terms of, you know, documentation, dealing with tariffs, dealing with changes in the business? What are the most important things from an ATO perspective here?
Yeah, look, there's a lot to think about. And maybe I can also just pick up some of the comments that have just been made too, because I think it feeds into what's your approach to your transfer pricing policy, and therefore the kind of approach you're taking into your documentation, so that you're really focusing your effort where it makes the most value. Like many of the people in the room, kind of have done transfer pricing for a long time, and sort of seen sometimes we make the mistake of getting too wrapped up in TP convention, and a whole lot of transfer pricing people talk to a whole lot of other transfer pricing people, and we convince ourselves that our conventions kind of define truth. But when the law kind of comes in, they're going to be thinking more about it from what's observable and the economic theory associated with things. And so we need to make sure that our TP conventions align with economic theory and observations. And if you look at what the economic, well, I know observations will take a little while to come through, but if you look at the economic theory has suggested, at least to me, that more often than not, tariffs fall on the consumer rather than back down into the value chain. And I'm not saying it doesn't have an impact on the value chain, but that seems to be a proposition coming through a lot of the economics that I've actually seen. And so what does that mean in our current situation? I think there's a real question about how will that play out in the US. So you have clearly the administration saying this is an external revenue, it's not revenue being raised internally, but we're waiting to see in the August, September, October figures for inflation what that starts to do in terms of creeping up. Now, if inflation goes down in the US at the same time as they're increasing the tariffs, then that starts to become a far more believable kind of story that, well, actually the cost of this is being passed down the value chain or up the value chain. But if we do see inflation going up in the US and the US economy continuing to grow, and I think there was that comment about the battleship takes a long time to turn around, then I think the kinds of observations maybe coming out of the TP mines, where a lot of transfer pricing people were sitting in a room talking to themselves, perhaps to me is a little bit more concerning than reassuring, just because it needs to be grounded in the economic theory. And then as observations come through around what do independent manufacturers find, what do independent suppliers find, what do independent distributors find, we have the opportunity to bleed in that observational data. The transfer pricing guidelines, which are obviously important to the interpretation of our law, tell us that tariffs are generally treated as a condition of the market in the particular jurisdiction. So in some ways, the starting point is, well, clearly this is a US issue. This is an issue for US distributors and potentially suppliers into the US. But recognising the broader conversation, the context, also understanding that it does have the potential to disrupt the global status quo because of the size of the economy that we're talking about. In terms of documentation, to come back to the specific point, I don't think it's hugely different to any of the themes that have already come out around being thoughtful in terms of where you focus your analysis to explain if there has been a disruption or there has been a change, material change to your value chain, then working through in as evidence-based a way you can in terms of show me the numbers, what it's actually done. And if there are assertions around the impact on the market in which you're operating, show me the numbers in terms of what it's meant for market share or whatever might be appropriate for a particular situation. And where the outcome of the transfer pricing policy compromises the Australian position, really be careful around capturing a commercial rationale, because you might, as part of a global policy, get told, hey, this is the way we're going to do it, but be careful that when, from a regulatory perspective, we come and look at it, we're going to be very much looking at it from what's the Australian commercial rationale that supports this new transfer pricing policy. And then lastly, and in conscious of time, the point around unbundling is a very important one. I think I've also seen that play out over the last few months in the context of how do we deal with return of sales kinds of approaches versus transactional approaches. And I'd just caution a little bit. I don't think it's going to be a big issue from an Australian perspective, because our tariff rates have been coming down. The government's position is we're not going to have retaliatory tariffs. So it's not like we're about to start sticking 50% tariffs on US goods. But to the extent to which you're using it as a tool to go into other countries, the transfer pricing guidelines tell us more often than not to start with as transactionally focused methods as we can. And so if you split out part of your revenue stream into a transaction that does not have sufficient substance behind it, you might find that the ATO or another revenue authority really wants to challenge it. So put in the work as you unbundle it to make sure that it has proper substance, because otherwise you're potentially fueling another source of disputes.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. I think when you do unbundle, you absolutely need to do the analysis behind what should the management fee be, what should the licence fee be, what should any of those fees be. And typically, I know from what I've seen over the years, that is what happens. But I think it's really a good tip to hear from the tax authority that that's what they'll be looking at, and they'll look at that in all jurisdictions. Maybe one additional observation I'd pick up on from what Keir has indicated, and maybe also some of the comments Damien was making before. Oh, and actually Sean made the important observation that there is no such thing really as this, you know, concept of limited risk distributor or LRD, which seemed to be a trend, you know, 20 years ago, and probably has lost that trend to some degree. Now it's routine distributor, not LRD, but nevertheless, the concept there, which I think sometimes the steps are missed, important steps are missed because of budget constraints, resource constraints, scope of work, etc. I think the quality of your functional analysis, most important step in any transfer pricing analysis, is to actually understand what's happening in the business operationally, who's doing what and where and how. And I think sometimes it's done really superficially, and sometimes it's not updated on a regular basis either. It might be updated, irregularly. And given the pace of change that we're experiencing now, and probably have been for a number of years, it's not going to be sufficient to leave too big a gap in terms of when you're actually, you know, looking at those business activities multi-sided, not centrally prepared, just everything that management think is happening, but multi-sided. So that would be my tip, that you really invest the time and energy in making sure you've got good quality functional analysis, DEMPI analysis, everything else from a multi-sided perspective. I'm conscious of time. We've got probably 2 minutes. And so what I wanted to ask the panel, in 30 seconds each, what is your one key message or insight, takeaway, that you'd like to leave in the room today? So I might start with you, Paul, if that's okay.
Yeah, it would be that tax doesn't need to set the customs position, but they do need to have oversight. So to Kier's point, you need to ensure that businesses are adopting things that are compliant, documented, and can be substantiated and aligned with the business. You do not want someone in supply chain asking a factory in China to print an invoice with $10 on it to evade duties, which is, it happens. And so that would be mine, just ensure there's kind of appropriate oversight, just because this is stuff that will be audited in 3 or 4 months' time.
Thank you. David?
Well, I'm spoiled. You met Craig earlier in the first panel. I get to work with Craig, who's a transfer pricing expert in our office. And I dare you to show me a transaction that has a transfer pricing issue that doesn't have a trade compliance issue or doesn't have a trade compliance requirement. If I don't hear from Craig every couple of weeks, I know one of us is missing a trick. Why is it? It's not why we should work together. It's how on earth are we not working together? That's really important. In this case, when you're talking about transfer pricing, there is always a trade compliance element, and it needs to be very carefully taken into account when you're thinking about the tax function as well. That cooperation and collaboration is absolutely key when things are as volatile as they are now.
Thank you. That was going to be my key takeaway. So double up on that one. So important. Kia, we're going to give you the last word. What's your key takeaway?
30 seconds. Again, don't jump in. Take a beat. Even if you don't have the evidence in the first place, think about it in a very analytical way and then have processes in place to trap the evidence as it kind of comes through.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. I'd like to ask all of you to join me in thanking this wonderful panel today, and particularly Kia, given he's not well.
Feel better, Kia.
Yes, feel better, Kia. I believe it's morning tea now, Lorena, so 30-minute break. Yep. So 30 minutes back in this room.